There's wacky Nicolas Cage. There's completely unhinged Nicolas Cage. This one I'm pretty sure is totally unhinged from what I've seen in the trailer.
It looks like he's playing the role of that, like the sagely, somewhat crazed sort of hermit of martial arts power.
He's sort of like he's sort of like feral Obi-Wan, you know? Like Scotch. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 286 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam and I'm not a pipe.
I'm Sam and I'm the artiste.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is November 2020, Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show. It's positive, but it's there. So just be aware.
I thought that you skipped the actual day of the month because I was having trouble grokking.
It's just a lot of 20s. Just
a lot of 20s.
A lot of 20s all stacked on top of each other. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thanks for letting us grab your money to support the podcast. All right, let's talk about life. Let's talk about how's that radioactive cat doing, Adam?
This is a big hit.
We talked about last week.
Yeah. Last week I talked about how we took our cat, new cat, old Earl Grandma cat, to get irradiated in a very specific way. Not blasted with radiation, which is one way to do it, but injected with radioactive chemicals, which is way more
different.
Cool, you know. It's way more rad.
Huh? Yeah.
See what I did there? So after that happened, we couldn't handle her, and we couldn't like hang out, and it was very sad. She was trying to get on my lap, and I had to be like, no, and she doesn't understand because she's a cat, so I just felt really bad, and I was like, how much does it cost to get a Geiger counter, you know? So I went to Amazon because, I mean, Amazon sells everything. I assume they sell Geiger counters. Sure enough, they do. And it turns out you can get one for $80, which is just not that much, you know?
It doesn't seem right. It seems wrong.
It's about as much as a good carbon monoxide detector.
Yeah.
You know?
So I saw that and I was like, okay. So on the one hand, if I got this thing, then I wouldn't have to take an extra trip to the vet, because the last trip to the vet is like 2 weeks after. They have to do it for a Geiger check where they then pass fail and say like, oh yeah, you still can't touch her or whatever, right? But as much stress as that causes her, like the whole – I was just like, you know what? If I can buy a Geiger counter for $80, it's kind of useful. Maybe there's someday we get irradiated by a nuclear thing and I can detect it. So, you know, it's a good investment, obviously. So
it's just fun to have. Like, that's
just gotta have fun.
Yeah. And that was a reality, it was just fun. I was talking to my wife about it, and she was just like giving me the eyeball, you know, and I was like, don't worry, buying it with my own money, not family money, because I get this. This is a little absurd. But really, it's just like a toy, you know? And so I got very excited about it. So that arrived on Monday. And I pulled the thing. It's actually a small thing. It's like the size. It's smaller than a TI calculator. It's like half that size. Actually,
I will say it is far sleeker and cuter and brighter feeling than any Geiger counter I have ever seen in any game context.
Yeah, I've only seen them in
futuristic context.
Yeah, you know? I've only seen them in movies where it's like a big ass, almost like one of those old flashlights. Remember those things? So it's like a giant flashlight with a handle on it. Yeah. It's just like a little device that looks like a. Shit, I don't know. It looks like a thermostat. It's like a thermostat or something, right? It's just a little thing. So I got it out, unpacked it, you know, and it has the clicks, which is just super fun, you know. And so it counts clicks per minute, and then it converts that into various metrics. So the metric that I'm using is microsieverts per hour, whatever the fuck that means. But
yeah, of course.
So I turn it on, and it's just ticking. And I was like, oh, so it sounds like in the movies, you know, where you get that little tick going. It's like random little tick spikes. As I pull it out, you know, I turn it on, and then new cat is just like walking in circles around the kitchen island where I'm doing this. And so I'm on one end of the island, and every time she hits my end of the circuit, like it just like ticks up a little bit, you know. But she's on the floor, so she's like 4 feet away, relatively speaking. So what I vaguely remembered from a million years ago with this kind of thing is that radiation falls off exponentially because it's going out in a bubble, right? And so – As you move away from the point source, then just less of it's hitting you, right? By exponential.
Because of volume.
Because of volume.
Basically.
And so I was like, okay, so if I can feel it, like, or I can hear it as she comes around, right? So clearly she's radioactive, which was already really hilarious just conceptually. But then I brought it down really close, and it just like it accelerates exponentially, like as you bring it close to the point source, you know, which I was just so fucking amused by. I just like, cause I don't know why it was just like a, it was like a from the movies kind of thing, you know, with like the Geiger counter ticking and like, yep, it gets more and more scary as it like starts, and it suddenly just accelerates and it's going like crazy. It's got like a little light on that's blinking and it starts blinking so fast.
Except on the, yeah. Except on the other end of it is just this adorable cat.
Yeah, just a cat. Yeah. Like, well,
it feels like, it feels like one of those horror movies, right? Where they're like trying to, like, what's happening in here? Uh-huh. And then they're like waving the detection wand and around. And then you find the source. Like, and you're like, oh, wait, it's the cat? And then, uh-huh, the cat's like, blah! It turns, you know, it turns into an eldritch horror or some shit.
Yep.
Except it was just your cat.
Yep.
It's pretty funny. So I made a video of it, which I posted in a few places, but if you go to my Instagram, that'll be the easiest way to find it, which is at
very music
at Dam Coster, ADAMN Coster. So if you want to see what the radioactive sort of path looks like going towards a cat, it's pretty funny. But yeah, so I've been every evening then when I'm feeding her, I just put it down by her bowl so that she's relatively stationary. And it's kind of a relatively constant positioning. So I've just been measuring it day by day just to watch it fall off, you know, which is, been very, I think the core lesson I took away from this experience so far is that measuring a phenomenon that falls off exponentially with distance on a moving target is very error prone. I think because literally you move an inch, because once you start getting close, like it's exponential, right? So it just, mm-hmm, accelerates. So if you're 4 inches away versus 2 inches away, you're going to measure two x ish the difference, right? And yep, and like that, so it makes it so fucking hard to tell like how fast it's falling off.
Can you just poke her in the side with it?
Yeah, the problem is that she wants to move, right? But I have found that like while she's eating, I can just like kind of nestle it right up against her butt, and then she can tolerate that pretty well. And so she's actually now down based on that below the range that they say she needs to be below before I can hang out with her again. So basically this weekend, I get a whole extra week of cat hangouts because I was otherwise going to wait until next Friday to find
just
out.
Don't put her on your lap directly because you'll become sterile. But other than
that, I'm doing it
just because of the exponential problem, right? Because like she could be 6 inches away from you and that's fine, but as soon as she's like right all on you, then now you're.
I'm gonna measure her because I think last night I got her at like a. I need to get her down to 5 of this. Who cares what this unit is? But I need to get her down to a 5. And last night, even when I had it like up against her butt, it was at like a 4 point something, you know? So even like if I had her on me, then I'm pretty sure I'm actually under. But the thing, like, it was interesting because I've been looking up units for this and like what expected rate dosages for radiation are and like what allowances are for like regular people versus people who are in a nuclear industry. And, you know, trying to like, it's quite fascinating. How all this works, and I think the most interesting thing to me is like just how conservative it is. Like, it's super conservative because with radiation, the idea is that there's no safe exposure level.
Yeah,
that's not a thing, right? It's all bad, but we're all getting irradiated all the time because of, you know, the sun is kind of the big thing.
But
also we're creating lots of waste. There's a little bit of just radiation kind of all over the place. So it's all bad. There's no such thing as like a safe dose, but it's another one of those like exponential things, right? It's like the more of it you get, like baseline versus 10x that, basically the same. Like it is 10x worse, but still basically the same, the same. And so it's been very interesting to kind of read about that and see. And now that I know what the guidelines are from like our vet for this treatment, and then compare that to what like is technically allowed, and then discovering things like, so what I found early on was that if I was sitting 6 inches away from her, so I was just like measuring it, I had the device next to me, and then she was just like laying down 6 inches away, so I could measure it, and then I could go look up these charts and be like, okay, so if I just sat like this and got this much radiation, right, then it would take about 100 hours of just like doing that, assuming that it never changed, right? So it would take about 100 hours to get to the point where I got the exposure, the average exposure for 1 year that is sort of like quote unquote allowed.
Just being a person.
Whatever, right? For being a person out in the world whose job isn't related to nuclear stuff and excluding
right,
like your yearly dosage that you get from, you know, x-rays and whatever kind of stuff, because that's added on top. And so I was like,
yes,
this doesn't seem like that big of a deal, you know, really? Mm-hmm. But they have to be very conservative about it, which, you know, all makes sense. But especially on their end, because at the vet, they're doing these every week. So they're just getting exposed to these levels every week. And then when they send it back home, if you've got like kids in the house, because also the guidelines go by age bracket, right? So if it's like, if you're, they say if you're 45 or under, you're supposed to stay on average 6 feet away from your pet when it comes home. If you're older than that, it's 3 feet. If you're a baby or a child, then they say they should be completely separated. There should be no possibility of interaction at all, because
don't put your radioactive cat on your baby,
which is good advice
at all.
Yeah. Good life lessons from this podcast, people. Yeah. Applicable.
So it's very interesting. So I don't know. I think it's fun to do science at home, even when all it does is just demonstrate exactly like what you would expect. Like there was no surprise there, right? It's like, oh yeah, like it's radioactive. It gets more radioactive as you get really close.
But still seeing the Geiger counter
tick
up as
it was very fun. So sometimes
it's a very satisfying feedback mechanism, you know.
Yeah, sometimes you gotta spend $80 and measure a cat just to have some.
Well, here's a question for you. Did you take this Geiger counter around and measure other things in your house?
I did.
Turn on the microwave and then like, because people are always like, microwaves, they send radiation at. Did it?
It has the wrong kind of
your cell phone?
Because this thing is detecting, you know, nuclear radiation specifically. So it's not detecting like regular old radio waves and stuff that you get out of microwaves. But I didn't actually try it. I tried it on a few, like the refrigerator and, you know, other kinds of stuff. Nothing did anything above baseline, so it was all very boring.
It
came with a little card that was like, it was like warning levels, right? So if it's like, if you're ambient, or if the rates like in some area are here versus here versus here, one of them is like, contact the government immediately, right? Which is what, that's what NUCAT is, right? If you get, so it was like, it was funny, like having this card, and it's like, if you get these measurements, it was like 1,000 ticks per hour or whatever. If you get these measurements, like call the government, right? And get this, like, this is not
right.
Okay situation.
There's a radioactive hazard.
There's a radioactive hazard, right? And I was like, yes.
It's your cat.
That's accurate.
Can you imagine, though, if you were like, oh, this is so cool, I get my Geiger counter so I can measure my cat, and then you just turned it on, and it was just like through the fucking
room. Yeah,
oh
just my God. Just,
while you're in your house, you're like, oh no.
That's terrible.
I've been living here for years. Well, that's crazy. Now, speaking of crazy things, there's something else that we need to talk about that's coming up. It's coming up the day that we're recording this episode. So I hope that by the time it airs, people have seen this, because there's a movie coming this weekend called Jiu-Jitsu, where the premise of the movie is every 6 years, every some number of years, there's like a comet or some kind of thing that comes and it summons this alien that is basically coming to Earth to fight people.
Yep.
It's not like a conquering alien, I don't think. I think it just comes to fight people.
And the alien also is just – it looks just like – I'm pretty sure it's just a person in a suit.
It just looks like a dude – yeah, dude in like a space suit.
It's like a more dark – it's like a dark Power Ranger is sort of how I feel it vibes.
And so my understanding of this movie from the trailer is that Nicolas Cage is some kind of jiu-jitsu fella.
Is he actually a martial artist for realsies?
I don't know, but
I don't know.
I guess we'll find out if he's really in there doing jiu-jitsu.
Is it wrong for me to say that it doesn't feel like Nicolas Cage is a martial artist? You know what I mean?
No, I mean, you're right. You're correct.
He's kind of an awkward dude, but you know, that's the secret. You know, if you're a brilliant martial artist, but nobody suspects it, then
that's how you beat the aliens. Because they might use the shaky cam approach to hide his.
Oh God, I hope not. But actually, some of the fight scenes from the trailer look pretty dope. Like I'm on board with this movie. This has the vibe of like Predator, but kind of dumber than Predator, you know, but just the idea of like this alien is coming and people have to stop it. And it's just like such a simple, like 90s action movie premise that I'm all about it. Mm-hmm. I'm except so excited.
I mean, actually, also, it is the Predator, because the Predator also just comes to hunt a few people. That's a total.
Yes. Like, yeah.
It's not bent on world destruction or anything so impressive as that. It's just like, you know what?
It's just here for fun.
It's just here to do a few murders and then take off, you know?
But wasn't it in the jiu-jitsu trailer? It was like, if this alien doesn't find a good fight, then he kills everyone.
I don't know.
I thought I heard a throwaway line where they like, they basically take the Predator's plot, but then like blow it up in terms of consequence.
I mean, there needs to be some reason that you would fight this thing, because like,
Because otherwise, why would you just run away
just be like,
for a couple days?
No. But yeah. Also, I mean, imagine, you know, you're a brilliant martial artist. You've been training your whole life, and the opportunity comes to fight an alien.
I mean, that would, and it's.
I mean, you would.
It's in hand-to-hand combat. Yeah, it doesn't have tentacles. It's like legit.
But it can turn invisible. Like a, if I understand that, from what I saw in the trailer, it is just a predator that punches you instead of rips your spine. Maybe it does rip your spine out because that's still hand-to-hand combat.
We'll find out. I'm sure.
Is that a jujitsu move? Ripping a spine out of a human body?
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's jujitsu. Yeah, because jujitsu is all about using your opponent's leverage against them.
Like their spine.
You know?
Yeah.
Like their spine. And ripping that out is a classic jujitsu move. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and also in this movie, there's several different flavors of Nicolas Cage, you know? There's like thoughtful Nicolas Cage. There's wacky Nicolas Cage. There's completely unhinged Nicolas Cage. This one I'm pretty sure is totally unhinged from what I've seen in the trailer.
It looks like he's playing the role of that, like the sagely, somewhat crazed sort of hermit of martial arts power.
He's sort of like he's sort of like feral Obi-Wan, you know? Like
we'll have a movie report next week with how this turned out. You know,
yeah. I'm so excited. So excited. All right. Now, anyway, we gotta move on from this because I could talk about how excited I am.
But roll away.
All
roll
fucking away. Day. Industry news. Apple has made an announcement. The announcement is that they are trying to look out for the little folks. They are cutting their revenue share from 30% to 15% for small developers. So Adam wrote up an article about this and has a lot of thoughts about it. So hit us with sort of like the high level. What do you think, Adam, are the consequences of this for Apple as well as for developers?
Well, I think specifically, I want to say first though that it's not small, quote unquote. It's basically if you make $1 million or less in revenue, right, through the App Store. Yeah.
$1 million in a given is the year. Threshold where you
– Yeah. And then you have to apply for it too. You don't just it doesn't just automatically happen.
It comes with some tiny fonts, you know.
Yeah.
So
take us away, Ed.
Yeah, the caveats are basically you have to apply for it. It goes on a year basis. So like if in the year you break that $1 million threshold, you basically like are kicked out of the program, right? So and then the following year you can't be in the program because like the last year you made that much. But then like the year after that, if the prior year you didn't make $1 million, then you get to reapply. So like they've made it as convoluted and annoying as possible versus just being like, we go on your calendar. If you up to $1 million, you pay 15%. After that, you pay. Like that would have been the easy.
It's like a graduated tax bracket situation.
Yeah. So if they truly cared, that's what they would have done because that's – nobody has to opt in. Nobody has to like discover that this is a thing. So they're kind of being butts about it, but I think there's a reason because the key thing that I saw when people were reporting on this that kind of like that just struck me as really interesting with a whole bunch of knock-on effects was that there's a company called Sensor Tower that does like massive analytics on the App Store to try to figure out what the hell is going on because it's all closed, so there's no way to know for sure what's going on, right? So you need to take all this stuff with a grain of salt, but their whole business model is basically trying to figure out what's going on in the App Store.
It's sort of the Steam Spy equivalent for the mobile market.
Yeah,
but far better actually in terms
of – Yeah, a whole company doing it, right. And so they sell data to companies and you can like pay them to do different things and whatever. So they claim – it was basically 98% of all publishers, all companies who are putting games out on the app or apps, because this is apps and games, right? It's the whole App Store. So 98% of all entities putting out apps are under this threshold, right? Which is consistent with our own knowledge of the industry and our talking to other developers and so on, right? That almost nobody is making significant, like huge significant revenue. Of course, $1 million is a lot, especially if you're a tiny team. And so that still doesn't actually expose just how unsuccessful most people are in the market. Right. Mm-hmm. So saying 98% of people don't make $1 million, it's like, okay, but if if most of those made $900,000 in a year, like then if they were small, that's still totally fine. But the important thing is that 2% that's left is generating Oh shit! What was the breakdown? 95%. Yeah, it's generating 95% of the revenue, right? So again, flipping it the other way, that means that 98% of people in that market are only generating 5% of the revenue. So, and that's the pool that this thing hits. So now, to me, this is very interesting because they set it up as an opt-in system where you have to apply. There's like these kind of caveats, right? Then it's going to be significantly less than that in terms of the hit that Apple takes. So they're not going to take a 5% hit on this. They're going to take a whatever percentage of that is people who are aware this is even happening. And then also, since once you hit that threshold, you get knocked out, you have to keep reapplying the whole thing, right? Then it's not.
And importantly, it's only cutting it down to 15%. It's not removing it. So it's also, even if they did apply it fully, it would only, the maximum that they would lose is 2.5%.
It's 2.5%, right? But yeah, so on their side, on our side though, as a developer, so they're potentially losing up to 2.5% if we're being like very pessimistic on behalf of Apple, right? On our side though, we're changing because you would think, oh, that's a 15% improvement, but that's not how percentages work. It's 85% instead of 70. So it's actually 85/70 in terms of percent improvement, right? So we're actually doing 21% better in terms of revenue, which is a fuckload. That is a huge. Yeah. That is a huge boost in revenue for companies under that tier, right? So to me, this is really interesting because they've created a system where, and this is the whole argument in taxing as well for having a what they call a progressive tax, right? It's as you make more money, you go to these brackets where you have to give up more and more of it because the idea is that at some point you don't need as much because you're doing fine, right? And you can afford to help everybody else out, right? is the idea, but the rationale. Further is that every time you take money away from somebody, you increase the risk that something bad happens, right? Because money is the system we use to survive. That's true as people, that's true as companies, right? So as a company, if 30% of our revenue is just going right to Apple, then that makes it that much less likely that we're around for as long, for as long as possible, because we have less money to work with than we would if we got all of it, because it's all relative, right? So it's like relative to all of it. If we got every single cent that we earned instead of 70% of it, then we'd last almost 50% longer, right? In terms of before we ran out of the money.
Again, that's the weird thing as far as the percentages go, right?
Yeah, it's a huge difference.
The difference between getting 70% of the total revenue versus getting 100% of it.
Yeah, it's enormous.
Yeah,
and it's a 42% increase.
Yeah, it's huge, right? Yeah. So if we got all that revenue, so because now you can go to the small company scale, right? A small company is on the verge of collapse basically 24/7. That's what being a small company is. A big company has a war chest. They've got investors. There's like money everywhere. Like, and they still can collapse, and they do, right?
But they've just got a lot more of a diversified risk profile.
Exactly. That's the key, they have a diversified portfolio because they have other ways of dealing with their money. So if you're like a Supercell, right? If you're Supercell, you're making like 10 different games at once. Almost all of them fail, but you're making 10, right? And you have the marketing power and the analytics power to convert those one or two successes every few years into something enormous because you're just gambling, right? And that's basically, as a large company, you get to gamble. As a small company, you're still gambling because that's actually just what being a company
is.
But now you're gambling. You get to roll the dice once every like few years. And everything
don't get a good roll.
Don't get a good roll. You're in a bad situation. And similarly, if you need to hire another person, that represents now like one half to a tenth of your staff, right? Like the impact of hiring a person is fucking enormous. The impact of losing a person is enormous, right? And so you take all these things combined, and just the risk profile that a small business has relative to a large business is just enormous. Large in terms of revenue is enormous, right?
So yeah, I like to think about it kind of like if you think about. The richest person in the world, Jeff Bezos, for his wealth, right? Compared to yourself, if you gained $100 million, that's like an unfathomable amount of money.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like you would have no concept of how much money that is because it is an unbelievably huge number. Mm-hmm. You couldn't spend it all. You couldn't figure out what the fuck to do with it. You could give away $99 million. You'd still be a millionaire.
Yep.
It's crazy, right? Jeff Bezos' money moves up and down by far more than that on a daily basis, right? Like it's a rounding error. If he lost $100 million today, it would not affect him whatsoever.
Well, same with Apple, right? So Apple losing this 2% potentially on their end, right? versus all these developers
gaining
20%. That asymmetry is really important, right? So
And so that's it's a similar kind of asymmetry.
Yeah, to it's the same idea. Yeah. So I think the interesting thing about this is that so people are saying like, oh, this is probably just a PR stunt because of all the lawsuits Apple's facing
for
big monopoly and there's potentially some truth to that. But I think to me, ignoring that question, I think the interesting thing is that this is actually a good, probably, because it all depends on the details, right? But it's probably a good business move because the companies that become so the companies that become those 2%, right, that generate 95% of the revenue, right? They come from somewhere, right?
Yeah, you have to pass through the eye of
you got to start as a small company and then you get there, right? Mm-hmm. And so Apple has this huge pool of companies, 95% of its or 98% of all the companies that are selling stuff on the store, right? Has this huge pool from which the huge companies come, right? But they could only come out of there if they survive long enough to do it, right? And so the higher the churn, so the churn there is just the same as it's like inside of a small company, right? The churn there means that a company went out of business. And so then it's very likely that if the company went out of business, that the people who are running it go off into the world and do other things. It's far less likely that they start another company, also making games or apps or whatever, right? And so the churn coming in then is basically people making apps and games who don't know what the fuck they're doing come in, right? If they survive long enough, they start to learn what they're doing, right? and they start making more and more successful stuff that starts to move towards being in that 2%, right? But the vast majority of companies don't make any money in the app stores. So they fail and they get kicked out and they get churned out, right? And then how much revenue did they create for Apple by doing that? Fucking nothing.
Well, at least $100 because they paid for it.
Right, at least $100. Right. So yeah, so they generate basically no money for the store, which also means that if they weren't paying any money to the store, there's no impact on Apple, no meaningful one, right? But by not paying money to the store, if it was literally zero, which is honestly what it should be, if it was literally zero versus 15% versus 30%, the difference is enormous in terms of the fraction of those companies that actually survive long enough to move into that next phase, right? To have just enough security where they – because if we talked many times in the podcast that about just how many times along our own journey we almost lost, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not insignificant at all. There have been many occasions, at least like three I can think of, like moments where we looked at ahead and we're like, oh fuck, right? And where things just worked out. They just like happened to work out and we had just a long enough runway to get to that point where we could keep moving forward. And
yeah, but if that runway was always 20% longer,
then it's just that much more likely that we get to just skip past those things, or we, we stumble across the thing that allows us to survive, or we get the game out just in time, or whatever, right? So to me, this is really it's a side of the argument that I hadn't actually thought about before, because I've been on the side the whole time that there should be a progressive tax basically in the app stores because anything else doesn't make any sense. But I hadn't thought about it from this perspective of just. I had coupled together the knowledge that we had that the vast majority of revenue for a store comes from a tiny sliver of the games there, yes. Right? I hadn't married that idea to the actual rates that we pay because the implication of all of that, this is then true for all stores, is that most companies make the store no money. Mm-hmm. Those are the same companies that are at risk of leaving the market, of leaving the industry completely. If you were to, in effect, invest in those companies in the same idea as a progressive tax, right? You invest in people by allowing them to hang on just long enough that they can get a better job, they can go get a better education, and they become bigger drivers of the economic engine. Since, of course, that's all we care about is people, is how much money people can make.
Sure.
but for businesses, it's the same deal and is a little less horrifying, right? But it's similarly horrifying.
Same thing.
So now my argument from all this is that this is probably actually a sound business move, but they need to take it. They need to take it further. Just cut it to zero, or ideally, they should just do a progressive.
Just graduate
version.
The thing. Yeah, just make it automatic. Yeah,
it should be progressive. Make it automatic, and then because the end result of that is that increases the likelihood that companies stick around long enough to become those things that generate, you know, like in the case of a Supercell or whatever, $1 billion or whatever the fuck a year for like those companies are generating so much revenue for the App Store. Like it's crazy.
I mean, beyond that, though, the thing is like you don't actually need a company to hit to land on that basically that exponential growth curve. Because if you think about, you know, this threshold they're giving currently of $1 million company. Yeah. You know, the maximum $1 million, if you make $1 million in a year, then you'd on the App Store, you'd pay again, $300,000.
Yep.
Goes to Apple. Okay. If that sounds like a lot, that's because it fucking is a lot.
It's a third. It's a third
of your talking money. About, and we're talking about $1 million company that, again, that might sound like a lot, but the reality is once you start running an organization that has fucking, I don't know, like even it's like 6 to 10 people who are of essentially like what you call, you know, upper pay, like roughly upper pay. So it's anywhere between like the $1,600,000 bracket, which by the way, in games is like,
if you're a software development company, then you have to pay competitive rates to get talent.
So this sounds like a lot of money and like a big thing, but the reality is that's like
it goes so
six
fast.
To 10 people and that's it.
Well, so that's not even because you also, you know, you have payroll taxes. So you like add about 15% on top of whatever you need to pay people that just gets taken out because you're paying people. Mm-hmm. And then of course those people pay taxes on their own income. So they take home far less, right?
Yeah.
So by the time, like, so you start with a million.
You're paying for an office, you know, potentially. You're paying for services. You're paying for infrastructure. Yeah, there's a
– Yeah, so the general point is like a $1 million company is actually in terms of scale.
It's a small company.
Extreme.
$1 million company is actually half of the revenue of the annual revenue of a typical McDonald's store.
Yeah. So importantly, when you're looking at something like the apps, again, we're talking about the app market in particular. So in other words, we're not just saying like, you know, 6 to 10 random people. We're talking like 6 to 10 software devs and artists and stuff. But the interesting thing to me is like, you don't actually need for this to be a really good idea. You don't need that company to make $1 billion the next year. It's literally the case that if that company were to make, say 50% more the next year or something like that, the store starts making like a tremendous amount of money off of that company, both in terms of like the total amount of cash that gets generated by them doesn't have to exponentially increase for this to be a sound investment. Like you don't need to go from our size to Supercell in order for this to make sense from like Apple's standpoint.
No, you just.
But I think it's
because it's the cost of churn. That's the thing that's not accounted for in the current system where it's just like, no matter who you are, no matter how much money you make, you just lose 30% of your revenue, right? And this is the same deal like when you're hiring people into a company, right? Like one of the reasons that pay is so high, and like in the tech industry in particular, is because people are trying to prevent churn, right? Because the cost of losing expertise and losing in particular institutional expertise, people who understand your company and your products and what you're trying to make and like know all the people and, you know, the cost of that to create that is 6 months to a few years of a person's time. And the whole time you're paying that person a fuckload of money, right? So if that person leaves, then it's not you're not just like, ooh, okay, I'm exchanging one cog for another and they cost the same per
month. Yeah, it's just not how it works.
That's not how it works because there's that investment cost. And I think we all understand this, or I guess business people understand this when it comes to running a business, right? It's like the cost of churn is fucking enormous. For some reason, in the app space and the software selling space, right, of the app stores, that isn't a concept.
It's not part of the conversation.
It's not part of the conversation of churn for companies coming into the app store or the app stores and selling their digital goods is also extremely expensive for the store. In exactly the same way that churn of employees in a company is extremely expensive. And well, in fact, so this whole like just take 30 no matter what, it just doesn't make any business sense. It makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it makes no sense. But I think it's very short-term focused, right? It's literally short-term focused. But I think there's an interesting opposite here, which is Steam, if you remember from last year.
Yeah, they're doing the opposite. Yeah.
Literally the opposite. So if you make over, what, 50 million or something, some zany amount, I think it's over 50
million. The more
million.
You make, the more you keep.
Yeah.
It's a regressive tax system.
If over 50, then you get 15%.
Yeah. Well, and for them, they're trying to keep people on they're trying to keep the big companies on their store because unlike the App Store, who has a monopoly on that market, Steam doesn't have a monopoly in that same sense because there can be competitors and there are. And so we saw, you know, over the past few years, we saw companies like Ubisoft and EA and so on, like making their own stores, doing their own thing and not putting their games on Steam because they didn't want to pay Steam 30%. Right.
Yep.
They're like, why the fuck would we do that? We don't have to. We can keep all of our money. And again, the difference is huge, right? Because that means like they now get a 50% increase in revenue by not selling games on Steam. So that's why
Steam about.
Yes, that's why Steam made that caveat there. They're trying to prevent losing that money altogether by doing that. But yeah, but it's a regressive system where the rich keep getting richer, right? And then the rest of us at the bottom of the store, and almost nobody on Steam.
It's not even the bottom of the store. Yeah, that's the thing. It's
the bottom 98% of the store.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's also possible though, because one thing we know is that stores do have a content glut problem.
Yeah.
Like they have so many apps, so many games coming out. Most of which are not intended to be competitive commercial products, right?
Yeah. But by having that churn, they're guaranteeing that the quality of that pool stays as low as possible because people who have experience are getting kicked out because they don't have enough money to make better stuff. Because if you think about our own thing, if we got kicked out of the store after our first like game, that would have been Talphite 2, right? That would have been our entire contribution to the ecosystem. Each game we added.
Say goodbye to Levelhead. Say goodbye to Crashlands.
Yeah, and upcoming Crashlands too, right? If we got kicked out of that market at any point, like, yeah, sure, we've got like some small, less good stuff in our portfolio. But each one was a building block to us being around for 7 years so that we actually know how to produce a high quality experience like and that we can get all the stores and so on. If we got kicked out early, just like all the other companies are, right? The only thing that would represent us there is that one game. We diluted
Talphite 2 and it's $1,500 of revenue.
Exactly, yeah, right.
And that's
as we gain more experience as a company, we dilute our own past bad products. And I'm using bad in a very loose sense here because they're not actually bad, but you know what I'm saying.
Right. Unsuccessful
products. Unsuccessful. We dilute our own unsuccessful products with successful ones, right? But if we only get the unsuccessful, because the first one is the unsuccessful one every fucking time, right?
Well, it is hilarious to think. Yeah, that Talphite generated $1,500. And of that, the stores happily took $500.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Actually, no, sorry. I think we made like $3,000. But
that was over. But I think that was over like a whole year.
Oh
like
yeah,
that's true. Yeah. But of that, the stores took $1,000. Right? Imagine that's insane. Right? It makes it so obvious what the difference is. Right? Like if you're one person, you're trying to like start a company. If you're a few people, whatever, you get your first game out, it makes like $10,000 if you're extremely lucky, right? And then just you get $7,000 of that now, right? Like that $3,000 difference is. You're in a situation that's untenable already, right? And if you then take just $3,000 away from somebody, So to me, like there's just
when you're that low, every last dollar is extremely helpful.
Yeah, well, this is this is true in tax systems as well, right? The whole system doesn't make any sense when you have people who are on the verge of collapse when you force them to also sacrifice into the system, right? Because those are the people who get churned out. They don't get the opportunity to move forward and then actually be the big producer. Because it's as Sam was saying, it doesn't have to be exponential growth, but it is, right? It's a nonlinear thing. Like when you build on success, that's an exponential thing. If you prevent people from being successful, you don't get that exponential growth, and so you're basically sacrificing exponential growth for linear. It's just, it's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. So I felt like I connected those two dots, and I was like, what is like? This was already stupid. And offensive that this is how
they're. But now, for some reason, it just got really obvious.
It got really obvious that this is offensive. And so, yeah. So anyway,
yeah. If you think about it as a tax and not as a fee, then suddenly the parallels are immediately clear.
Yeah.
Because essentially, it's this is a giant entity that dictates the terms of the market, and also creates and supports all the infrastructure of the market, much like the government. Yep. The government takes care of the roads and the power supply and all that stuff, right? Right. Same idea. It's a utility. There are actors coming in trying to get by, trying to generate income for themselves, and it's just a flat 30% flat tax, right? Which any economist will tell you a flat tax is always incredibly disproportionately punishing to people on the lower end of the spectrum, because of the diminishing marginal returns of wealth.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So anyway, right, well, if you're one of the stores listening to this, just quit fucking around and just make like you have Come no. On. It's unethical and it's stupid business to be doing it the way that everybody's doing it. So please just.
Well, this is the first time that I think the framing is appropriately pointing out that there is probably far more to gain by pursuing a graduated system like this than there is to lose. in the sense that like this whole thing of everyone's like, oh, well, I mean, you know, Steam's not gonna get less money. And it's like, under a circumstance like this, it's highly unlikely that they would earn less money.
On year one, they will. But on year on year like 5 and then 10 and then whatever, like it's actually because this is investing in the future by increasing the probability that you get more good
winners on your platform
and more winners on your platform.
And really, you know, if they took it even one step further where they said it's not about annual revenue, it's about just the monthly payout. If they said like, okay, you know, your first 10,000 a month is not, there's no.
Yeah, it should be on the payout, not on the.
Right, because then what would happen is if they feature your game, they give it visibility that month. It makes a lot more sales that month, and now they can justify taking their cut, right? But if they don't feature it, then it's just laying around in their store, and if you happen to make income from it,
it's a discoverability thing too, right? Like, because the question that – because one of the arguments that's always happening on the developer side is like, what am I paying for with that 30%, right? Because we know it doesn't cost us 30%. Like globally across all apps and so on to maintain just the store as a piece of infrastructure, right? Like we know without a doubt that it doesn't cost that much to do it. Yeah. And so what are we paying for, right? Well, we're paying for, on the one hand, we're paying advertising is what it is, right? It's basically, it's a built-in marketing cost. But if the store doesn't market your game, then like, why are you still paying that?
If no traffic is driven to your game's page, if you're making one sale a week, And 16 people see your game every week, and then they take 30% of that sale. You know, just feels a little bit, dare I say, unjustified.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of progressive taxes in real life, and I'm a big fan of progressive taxes in markets. And
The full acknowledgement that these companies, whether it's the government, whether it's Apple, whether it's Steam, whatever, they need money.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do need money. That's not in question. It's just where that money comes from and how the effect of taking that, what is the effect of taking that money from people in the market and how you do it, you know. It's pretty interesting. I guess we'll see what happens in the coming months.
But if you take that in the extreme too, because the same. Again, it's like taxes are – I'm actually glad that Epic is referring to it as a tax because it's actually the best way to think about it. But in the same way that you know, whatever it was like 50 or 60 years ago when we had like really progressive taxes where the top was paying 90%, right? Kind of the interesting thing because people – on the one side, people argue, oh, that prevents people from being incentivized to like do stuff and once they hit that mark. And like – but the other side of that is that it removes winner-take-all systems, right? Because actually I think it's important that people have their incentives reduced at some point. Once they have won in the system, get them the fuck out of there.
They won capitalism.
Yeah, they won capitalism. Get them out of there because their existence makes it harder for other people to also win, right? And so
this also though speaks to people's lack of understanding about how marginal tax brackets work.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people
It's not that like If say let's say like at $10 million of income, there's a 90% tax rate, right? That doesn't mean that
it retroactively applies to your first 10
million. I hit $10 million and now I just paid $9 million back. No, it's for every new dollar you make after $10 million, you would only keep 10 cents, right? Like it's so you would actually still have most of your money by the time you get to that point, you know, and then you keep less and less of it as you go higher and higher.
But anyway, I think the point is that because people are like, oh, well, it's unfair because like you work for it, whatever. It's like, well, no, because we don't even go into the ethics of like how it's impossible to become that wealthy unless you're oppressing people, right? But even that aside, the fact is that there's a finite amount of wealth. That's how economies work, right? There's a finite amount of it. And so the more of it that gets accumulated in one place, the less there is for everybody else. It's just fucking like brain dead. Simple, obvious stuff, right?
Scarcity of resources.
The more of it that I have, the less you can have. That's just the reality, right? So, and this is true also in markets. This is true in the App Store because the more eyeballs that a game gets, the fewer that everybody else gets to get because there's a finite number of eyeballs that
can possibly get. It's a zero-sum game.
And so by not having a progressive tax where Because if Supercell is getting like, if they have to pay 90% after their first $500 million or whatever, right? Then the incentive for them to continue making revenue off of that game and like just dumping more and more shit into it and like building their teams enormously and like doing every analytics thing in the universe to try to like squeeze out every last dollar goes down and down and down, so that now they're back in the pool with everybody else trying to like, okay, that means we got to make a new thing. Or that means like, actually, we're fine here because that's enough money, honestly, right? So we don't need to have this exponential growth of the company, because exponential growth of companies can only be supported by regressive tax policies, right? Or regressive, which we see in the real world, right? Or regressive platform tax policies, which again, like if those are allowed to be exponential, which is for some fucking reason, everybody's business goal is to have is growth, right? Exponential growth. That can only exist in an ecosystem where everybody else has to lose. So yeah. I want a progressive tax system on the platform and in real life, as just aggressively as we can make it.
Boom.
There it is.
It's the only ethical I'm down with that.
Yeah. All right, let's get on to some questions. All right, these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest up footed question comes from Flyhoppy Axe Rompa, who says, a few people have said there is an unknown but real end date to the indiepocalypse. People that weather the storm now and release a game in 2 to 4 years will be able to obtain the easy or easier success of early indies. What are your thoughts? And right out of the gate, I say there is absolutely no reason to think that that would occur.
Agreed.
Because the indiepocalypse is here, I guess, as people understand it. Okay, maybe we should just take a step back. The indiepocalypse is essentially just the idea that it's becoming harder and harder to succeed as a small developer.
Yes.
Right? The reason that that's true is because the tools are so good. The tools for making games are really, really good, and they're getting better all the time.
It's getting easier to make a game that people would be willing to buy.
Yes. And that's a big business, right? Like Unity, GameMaker, Unreal Engine, you know, these big players who make these tools are doing very well for themselves. And they're going to keep improving those tools. As long as it keeps getting easier to make games, the supply of games will be high. I don't know if it's going to go up, but it will be high, right? And just because new platforms appear, things like, you know, Google Stadia or whatever, doesn't mean that it's going to just suddenly become easy again.
Well, yeah, I mean, because the idea here presumably is that because these companies are competing on content again, which they hadn't been for like a decade or something, right? And that's not fully true, but like that's kind of the idea, right? So they hadn't needed to compete on content because like there was just so much of it, and in terms of indie content, there's just so much of it. Just pick one, whatever. It doesn't actually matter, right? But now, and also all the platforms are doing well. All the they'd already won their different markets or whatever, right? So they're all kind of like just sustaining. But now all of a sudden, there's all these new opportunities in terms of these new markets that people are trying to create. And so the idea here is that because of all these new markets, there's now a need for content again, right? And a competition for content, because exclusivity is still kind of the core tool that all these companies use to fight each other. Where exclusivity is and where these business deals are and where risk is, because now they have to pay for the risk of you putting your content on their fledgling store, right? Then that's where opportunity is for you as the content provider. That's all true. But the indiepocalypse has to do with scale, and it has to do with the fact that there's a fuckload of indie developers. And as Seth said, there will continue to be a fuckload of them. There is not enough competition to have all those indie developers make a bunch of money. And what the indiepocalypse is, like if you look at how people have tried to explain it, it's not that you can't be successful as an indie. It's that basically the same number of indies are still successful today, like by year, right, as were becoming successful 10 years ago. There are just far more of them trying. And so the probability that you're in that successful pool just keeps shrinking.
Yep.
The size of that pool is like growing a little bit because of all this competition. But actually, more importantly, the value of being in that pool is growing a lot, because it's still like these companies are competing for people who've already established that they're successful and that they can make good content, right? Yeah. So it is not the case that in 4 years, like if you're like coming out swinging like, ooh, I'm an indie and like I'm going to make a game, but I don't have a successful portfolio already, that it's going to suddenly become easier.
Well, I think this is what I want to get to as far as the question, because the question was, if you weather the storm now for two or 4 years, will you have an easier time in the future? And the answer is actually yes.
Yeah,
but not because of any end apocalypse related stuff, just because of what
the tools will be easier.
Yeah, what should be happening to you as a business,
you'll have
to
more experience.
Industry. Yep. More experience, more contacts. Hopefully you won't make as many dumb decisions. Maybe even get funding up front. Boom. Now you're guaranteed to be successful. Who gives a shit now? Make your own game, whatever. The subscription platform. So maybe you have networked in, you know, people at Game Pass or something like that, and you can actually get a deal figured out before your game is launched. All this stuff. Even these tools that – none of these tools were things that we even were aware of as opportunities when we started Levelhead development, right? These are things that throughout Levelhead's development, you always keep your ear to the ground and start paying attention to where things are moving, who you should know, et cetera. And so if you're constantly improving in that regard, then it really – and this basically goes back to what we were talking about with the Apple tax thing. It really is the case that survival
is the key.
Is sort of – yeah, it's just the key. And that's what we talk about this in the podcast a lot. But it's really the case that, like, if you can just manage to survive for long enough
– then an opportunity will be there.
Exactly. You'll have a moment, usually at some point, if you manage to survive for long enough.
But it does require
a breakout.
It requires survival. You got to be there to take advantage of it. But it also requires that you be prepared to take advantage of whatever opportunity comes up, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you are, let's say, a Steam developer, you make PC games and you put them on Steam. That's what you do, right? Then your opportunities are tied to your ability to – if you only look at what's happening in the Steam market, then you're limited in the things that you could take advantage of by what happens in the Steam market. That's the only thing you can do, right? If you are diversifying across multiple markets, if you are at minimum, you know, making it so that your games are playable in other kinds of ways and so on, right? Then now there are more opportunities available to you when they come up. Because first of all, you'll see them because you're not just looking at what Steam is doing, but you'll see them. But also you're poised to take advantage because a lot of this stuff has to do with time. It's all timeliness, right? It's like it's
how – so much is timing. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's how lucky are you that you've got a game ready to go, right?
When the Switch launches, for example.
Right, when the Switch launches,
you know?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got it ready to go and you can get it on that platform really, really fast because you designed the game to work in a such a way that it doesn't need as many buttons because Switch can make it limiting for your input controls, right? Mm-hmm. Or because you made the thing work on with a touch device. And then let's say Apple Arcade comes to you and they say, oh yeah, hey, we like what you're doing. We'd love to have this game on our store. If you can get it to us by the launch of Apple Arcade, of course, it's already happened. But like, if you can get it to us in the next 3 months, right? Right. This game is
but these things
done.
Are happening all the time.
They're happening constantly.
Yeah. But I think though this is an important distinction because what you're describing is just getting better at making games and doing business.
Yes.
Right?
Which
is not the same. Which is not the same as the success of the early indies.
Yes.
Correct.
With the early wave starting in like 2009 to 2012.
Right. It was pure content success, not business.
It was tools appeared to make it easier to make games. They were still pretty hard to use, but like if you were technically savvy at that time, then you could do it. You could do it with a small team. And few enough people were doing it. Few enough people were even aware that it was possible, that the competition was very slim. And you also had things like Xbox opening up their market to indies for the first time. You had the launch of the iPhone and the App Store around that time, right? And
Steam opened
the market, up. Yeah, the market of players
Steam opened up.
Was only used to playing a limited set of AAA games, right? They then got exposed to a limited set of indie games. But there wasn't a meaningful distinction between the idea of indie and AAA at the time. Right, because there was still a very tiny number of highly curated games.
But I would say though, by about 2010, you started seeing people talking about indie games in almost a reverent way, right? Where it was like, mm-hmm. These are the kinds of games made by small teams of passionate people that are pushing the medium into new places, right? And there was this kind of like wistful, almost magical way of talking about indie games at that time, and people would actively seek them out. You know, mm-hmm. That's not true anymore.
There are a dime a dozen.
There are a dime a dozen. There's trillions of indie games. You know, you can't throw a rock in any direction without hitting an indie game somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So, So I think there's a variety of cultural factors. There's timing problems. But the fact is, like, if you weather the storm, like Adam and Sam are saying, if you weather the storm for 4 years, it will be easier for you to make and sell games, not because of the market, but because of you, right? Mm-hmm. The market will never be as easy as it was at that time. Like, that ship has sailed. The tools mm-hmm. are here.
But the market for you, because of your success as a business, may be easier at that time, right? So, because as Seth was saying, it was a different, you were solving a different problem back then. Back then, you just had to get a piece of content fast.
The hard part was making the games.
It was making the games.
In 2010.
And then, like, the rest was still hard. We don't want to, you know, completely discount that, right? But it was, but it truly was really the case that, like, getting the game out and was the thing that you had to do. And that was the gate that people had to get across. Now it's not that at all. Now it's actually doing the business part in a saturated market, which is extremely difficult. And to go back to the earlier stuff, right? Everything is a rich get richer scheme. It all is, right? And that's true of the market. And in this case, rich can just mean like your
contacts,
how long you've been alive and how many contacts you've accumulated and all this kind of stuff, right? That's a kind of wealth. That's a kind of opportunity. And the longer you're around, the more of that you have. And therefore, the more opportunity you have, right? So surviving is the core part, but just surviving is not. So
it reminds me of like apocalypse scenario. If you want to throw this into the apocalypse language, it's sort of the group of survivors who has a belief that over there, you know, in Seattle, they figured it out and it's safe and we're going to go to Seattle because it's safe in Seattle, sort of a thing. I think this is maybe Last of Us or something. I can't remember who. Someone's always going to Seattle to try to save themselves. So it's like, oh yeah, there's a group of people who have it figured out. And like, once we get there, it'll be safe versus essentially saying we are where we are and we will figure out how to make it work.
Let's start rebuilding society here.
Yes. And the longer we work on that here, the easier it will get. It's sort of like it, you know, with the storm metaphor here. It's the difference between trying to sail into calm waters when, frankly, there may not fucking be any ever, versus just working on your ship in the rain while you're doing all this stuff, right?
And keep it upright.
Yeah, that's keep all it upright and make it more and more weatherproof over time until you don't give a fuck that there is a storm. Mm-hmm. You just don't. You're just doing your thing.
Well, and of course, what you'll always see in those movies is people would be like, oh, we got to get to Washington, D.C. Oh, we got to get to Seattle. We got to get wherever. On the way, they always run into somebody who's coming from there.
Yep.
Going the other direction. Right. Like, right. Oh, it's terrible over there. We heard that it was fine over in Ohio or some shit.
Yeah. And there is the chance because you build up your town and you get it all figured out. And then like the zombies overrun you. Like that's the reality of the world. It's rough, right? But it is still the more sensible approach than just going off on a infinitely long, uncertain journey to a destination that you don't actually
know. May or may not exist.
That may or may not exist. You know
what this kind of reminds me of, actually? This reminds me of finance, of the sage advice of my finance professor for investing, where he says, you can't time the market.
Yeah.
You can't ever know what the right move is when it comes to like where to put your resources, in this case money, right?
Yeah, this is true in the stock market as well as when you're deciding to make a video game, for example.
Yeah. So if you look at a stock and you think, ooh, I'm gonna put some money into that stock because I think it's gonna go up super fast, right? The fact is you're not the only person with that thought. Other people around the world will be looking at that stock and think the exact same thing. And there's a really good chance that a lot of them have already bought a bunch of that stock.
Yeah. So now the because price is inflated. Believe it.
So now the price is up, which means the price might actually be too high. And so when you put your money in thinking it's going to go up, it actually is going to go down, right? Because what you see in the present is a reflection of other people who have already been acting on the market, right?
Yeah. So what happens in the future is also a consequence of how all the other people are acting in the market. So it doesn't matter if you right now see a hole and you're like, that hole's going to be – I'm going to fill that hole. But you fill it 3 years later, right? like we did with Levelhead, right? Like if you do that, you can't know what's gonna actually happen in 2 years. And so, and if you saw that hole, so did everybody else, right?
Well, you know what's about to happen. I think I'm gonna put a date on it. I think within the next probably 2 months, we're going to start to see the first wave. Actually, it's probably already starting, but we'll start to see the first very visible wave of fairly well-polished Among Us style games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's actually a lot like the Bitcoin thing. Bitcoin was around since 2009. Nobody gave a fuck. All of a sudden in 2017, mm-hmm. boom, a single Bitcoin is worth $20,000. Not because of anything that happened with Bitcoin. And not because of anything about the core tech, but because everybody suddenly got on the same page about it, right? And now all of a sudden, everybody believes that it has value. And then all anybody can talk about is cryptocurrencies and blockchain and stuff, right? So same thing with Among Us. Like I was kind of chuckling about, I think the video game awards or whatever. They had Among Us listed in their like top mobile games or something like that. And it's alongside tons and tons of games that have come out in this past year. And I thought it's so interesting how Among Us was there in the video game awards when like that game's been out for years now. Mm-hmm. And I was like, maybe they should have a little asterisk next to each category. It's like top mobile game asterisk that we're aware of, you know? But yeah, so I guess my broader point with all of that is that you don't really know what the market's going to do. And if you have an idea about what you think is going to happen, you're not the only person with that idea. And whether it's jumping onto a trend or trying to launch into a new market or starting to use a new tool or whatever the case may be, you're not the only person. There's a lot of competition, and that huge amount of competition is what makes it so hard.
It is, but it is still about timing, because unlike the stock market where you can buy a stock in a millisecond using a robot, right? You can't make and launch a game in a millisecond, right? So there are some cases here where if you and this actually brings us back to that prior point, right? If you are poised because of your tech, because of your knowledge, because of the people that you know, because of your business relationships and so on, to take advantage of an opportunity before somebody else is, because you can get there first. You can see the opportunity, and it's not going to take you 3 years to get there, because the filling that hole doesn't require making a whole game and delivering it 3 years later, right? Mm-hmm. If you already have the game, and somebody comes to you and they say, "Hey, we want your game on our platform. We're launching this platform in 3 months," right? If you can do that, then most people can't, right? So you being able to do things that most people can't because of how long you've been around and because of you being ready to take advantage of opportunities is a real way.
There's less competition.
That's where there's no competition. Less. Yeah. Yeah. There's still a lot less, because scale,
You're not going to be the only one who can deliver a port of a game in a few months, but you will be one of the few. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So hope that – I think it kind of answers the question. So I think that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers Fat Bard and Jen Coster for putting the podcast together, and thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.